Hello and welcome to Last Week on Earth with Gary. Today's guest is Bjorn Stevenson, the director of the Max Planck Institute for Meteorology in Berlin. Bjorn is a top climate scientist with particular expertise in clouds. Listen on for insights on the real level of alarm of climate change, what the Earth may look like in the future, the development of thinking over the history of discovery, and why clouds are so interesting. Enjoy, subscribe, and share. You've been accused of criticizing your colleagues for being very alarmist in terms of topics around climate change, information going out about climate change, and how severe the impact that we know of is or can be. And you said that we still know far too little. What would you describe the actual level of alarm to be in comparison to very strong language around it and the need to mobilize every power that we have so that we don't get to very disastrous consequences that are in the news or being talked about, but actually can focus on looking at how we can mitigate it, and what is the actual level of alarm at this moment?
Yeah, there's a hard thing that kind of goes on there, and it maybe depends a little bit on how you see your role in society, because, you know, what is the purpose of science and what's our role in society? And I think people have different views on that. So it could be that you scientifically identify the need to do something to prevent some greater harm. And so if people aren't listening to you, then the question is, what conclusion should you draw from that? So, you know, the world is warming and pretty sure uncomfortable things will happen, and it will have in some places some catastrophic consequences somewhere at some time, maybe already is. But, you know, will most people notice in their lifetime how different the world will be? That's maybe a bit harder question to answer. But we're convinced that the trajectory the world is on is maybe not good for humanity, and you want people to try to change course. So you can explain that to them, and then they might listen, and they might not listen. And so what do you do if they're not listening? So one thing you could do is try to create a discourse which will cause them to listen. I don't know, I kind of call that politics. So that's fine too. We have lots of politicians, and that's why we have politicians. There's nothing wrong with politics. And I'm glad if a lot of people engage in that. But then you're being a politician, you're not being a scientist. And I think there's a certain value to have scientists. I'm kind of a fan of the ivory tower. It's kind of the place where you go to when you really want to know the truth, and you know that the person in the tower really doesn't give a shit, you know, because that's kind of a nice feeling, is that the person's really going to tell you what they really think is happening, not because they want you to do something, but because they're kind of weird and they like understanding these things. And I tend to subscribe to that sort of old-fashioned view of science, where it's a segment of society that criticizes, that thinks about how things work. And when people are interested, we try to explain it. Yeah, so that's maybe where the criticism is, because when we, you know, the reality is that global warming is a serious issue. It's also clear that humans are responsible, and that not enough is being done if the goal is to stop the warming. So that's all perfectly clear. But then the question is, if not enough is being done, if the goal is to stop the warming, you know, what's the scientific consequence of that? And of course, you can speculate about all the things that could conceivably happen if we don't change things. Yeah, but I tend to think that this sort of scientific speculation, or this idea that just because we don't know something won't happen, that means it will happen, or that we should be worried about it. Maybe I come down on a different side when it comes to how to deal with that than some of my colleagues, because the reality, of course, is that most of the things, it's not like the world's going to end in 10 years or 20 years. If, you know, it's not like 2 degrees of warming is suddenly hugely different than 1.9 degrees or 1.8 degrees or even 1.5. I sometimes ask my colleagues, what's the difference between 2 and 1.5 degrees of warming, other than one is, you know, 4/3 of the other? So 2 degrees is warmer than 1.5, and 1.5 is warmer than 1. So if we look at what's happened with 1 degree of warming and we imagine it 50% worse, how wrong would that be? And if we get to 1.5 degrees of warming and we imagine it at, you know, 33% worse, how wrong would that be?
We're also talking from the perspective of Central Europe that globally is not necessarily the place where it's going to hit soonest or heaviest.
It's true, but you know, I'd say this, and I'm sure it'll be misquoted and misinterpreted, but it's not like most people really care about poor people. So sometimes I have this very, I don't know, cynical view that climate change is something rich people talk about to make themselves feel better, because there's so many things we could do that would address the reality of poverty today without wringing our hands about the children and the future generations of the poor people. I mean, if you look at the growth of inequality, inequity, unequal access to healthcare, to education, to resources, you know, there's so many things that could be done today that it makes me a bit cringe when people say that we're approaching climate change because we have to protect the less fortunate. I mean, the reality is there's plenty of good reasons to worry about climate change from our own point of view. And if you're really worried about it to help people who are less fortunate or to help future generations, there's plenty of things which are causing more harm now that maybe we should be worried about.
Wow, I agree with that.
You know, I don't want to come across as
no, like, it's very
you shouldn't
refreshing.
Do anything. I mean, these are big and important and serious issues, but there's also a lot of hypocrisy that floats around in this arena.
I agree. And it's actually, it's quite nice hearing it from the perspective of someone that isn't a politician and doesn't work at a charity or a newspaper, that the approach is quite detached in a way that makes the information more clear and doesn't cloud it with what is popular right now to talk about at conferences, what politicians yeah. can use to get more votes or to become more loud because it's alarmist language, to look like they're kinder because they talk about the global south or more impoverished or regional minorities or anything like that. So yeah, it's quite refreshing to talk about it without all of those social burdens, to see it more clearly in terms of what is actually happening. Anything happened in the last week that has caught your interest?
Yeah, lots. On Saturday, it was raining like mad all over Japan. Tropical storm kind of was decaying outside of Japan, and it was mixing with a monsoon front. And they had this line of precipitation that went from the very southwest of Japan all the way up the coast. And some places in Japan, I heard, got as much as half a meter of rainfall in 24 hours. So it was crazy. And we had, I knew about it because we had a guest from Japan, and she was explaining the ways in which the tropical weather interact in the summer in Japan. So you have, you know, the onset of the Mayubayu monsoon season, which is this jump in moisture that goes to Japan. You have typhoons, and you have lots of variability associated with large-scale atmospheric waves. And it makes the weather very complex and exciting. And she was visiting us. We were at a workshop in Spain. And she said, you know, your weather here in Europe is pretty simple, isn't it? So that was exciting. The other thing that was exciting was that we were at this workshop in Spain where we began playing with this new generation of climate models. So we've been developing climate models which operate on a completely different scale than's been possible in the past. And so we had a workshop where we invited about 150 people to play with those for a week, and the results. So that was exciting. And maybe the most exciting thing today is that we're sending out a paper for comment, which we call a draft concept for EVE, and EVE stands for Earth Virtualization Engines. And so it's kind of the kickoff of this idea that climate science can do a lot more to help people understand whether things like what we're seeing in Japan are more in store or not. So yeah, it's been kind of a fun week in that regard.
Okay, well, now I have a million questions. Okay, first question. That's really cool. So a lot of people, when they travel, they sort of follow, okay, what kind of cuisine is in different places, or what kind of architecture or cultural activities. So what's it like traveling the world and paying attention to the weather or climate? Is that the first thing you notice? Do you look up into the skies and like feel how humid it is and just kind of follow the clouds?
It sort of happens, you know, though, when you said that, It made me think, because I've followed a little bit in my thinking the history of how people thought about clouds. And that was exactly that. You know, for a long time, people grew up in a certain area and they wondered if the sky looked different in other areas, you know. So people had this little catalog of clouds that they came up with. And the question is, if you went somewhere else, would you see the same cloud types everywhere? And you can imagine you'd really have no way to know that. Imagine you kind of grow up. I guess you said you're in the, you know, you're podcasting from Central Europe and you see the clouds in Central Europe and you ask yourself, you know, if I go to Scandinavia, will they look the same? Or if I go to Spain? And partly it's true and partly it's not true. And so, of course, when I travel, I'm sensitive to the environment, but maybe not that much more than someone who likes the outdoors or who likes to go hiking. And I do think a lot about the cuisine, I must say. So I was in Japan for 7 weeks and I was sensitive to the differences in the weather and the humidity and the smell and the sky. But I wouldn't say that I was that much more sensitive than an average person who likes being outdoors.
I always travel for the food. For me, any kind of exploration or vacation is sitting in a pub and eating food and drinking beer or something like
that. Yeah, you know, that's my wife and I, we went to Japan and certainly the food played a big role. And I could go on for a long time about the food, but...
That's another podcast.
yeah, that's another. And the craft beer too, the craft beer and the coffee scene in Japan is really terrific. So I probably know more about their coffee and beer than I do about their clouds, but I can talk about their clouds. There are some interesting things there.
What's interesting about clouds in Japan?
Well, it turns out that you know, when I said that, I was thinking of this guy who was the first to film clouds in motion. So in the early 1900s, people developed this sort of time-lapse technique to visualize things that were changing slowly. And I don't know, every time you look at the sky, it's different, but we never see it really move, right? We'll see a cloud blow across the sky. And when we see these time-lapse movies of clouds sort of billowing up and, you know, exploding with rain or something, it's always cool because we never can see that ourselves. You know, our brain can't keep track of the images long enough and the clouds moving slow enough that the sky's always changing, but we really don't see a change in a funny way. And so he made time-lapse photos of a cloud over Mount Fuji. And it turns out in certain weather conditions, there's always kind of a hill-capped cloud over Mount Fuji. And he found it funny because most of the time when you see these little puffy cumulus clouds or clouds like you would see over Mount Fuji, you know, you see them kind of skate through the sky. You wouldn't really see them evolve. You'll see them move with the wind. So they are moving, but you don't really see them evolve. They're just kind of moving through the sky with the wind. But this cloud, this little hanging cloud, would just stay right at this one spot on Mount Fuji. And he just found it fascinating how it would stay there. And then the time-lapse movie would allow you to see that it's staying there, but it's also evolving. It's constantly renewing itself as the wind flows over and through it. And so that was kind of an interesting thing in a Japanese cloud, because it was the first time that people taught us how to see clouds in motion, which they always are, but which we never get to see. And it's a nice illustration about how technology can allow you to see things in the world in new ways that you normally wouldn't be able to see.
Originally, I wanted this episode to be called The Future of the Earth. And when I was researching for this episode, it was so strange because looking through the internet, all the possible topics and questions around what I was researching was very human-centric. It was very, what's the future of the earth for people or for politics or for industry and so on. And my actual question is the future of the earth, eliminating the question of people on earth and just thinking about what earth would look like. Is it possible to describe what earth will look like in 100 years or in 1,000 years? Obviously, it's a very long way away, but can you imagine as a scientist what it might look like in 100 years without thinking about the implications of humans as well?
Yeah, that's kind of our business in a way, isn't it? I mean, climate scientists, because it's not that we really care about people when we study the field, otherwise we'd be social scientists. So, you know, we're interested in climate, not as a secondary thing because it affects people, but just because climate's fascinating. You know, we notice the seasons, we notice the passage of the days, we notice the difference from one place to another. And as a scientist, you want to try to explain why that is, you know, why why, you know, one place on Earth has a very different pattern of weather than another place on Earth, why that varies with the seasons, how that varies through the course of the day. And people are kind of secondary. And I think that it's probably true for most pure climate scientists. People are interested in it because they're interested in the phenomena itself. And when it comes to climate, of course, then you try to imagine how it was in the past and how it was in the future. Mm-hmm. And the thing about the past is you have all these clues that you can go around. So if you go into the history of how people first began to think about the emergence of ice ages, you know, how did that idea come into people's heads? There were clues that they could follow. The future is different. Normally for the future, we don't have clues. We might have trends, and we love to extrapolate from trends. And then, of course, we have physics, where you say, well, if I'm thinking about this problem right, or if I'm thinking about, if I understand how the world works, then if this and this happens, then that and that will happen. So we do that all the time in the future. We kind of test our understanding of how the climate works by imagining what it could be like under different conditions, and hence the future. And then for the timescales, every timescale you look at, you bring into play different processes. So how things look like in 100 years might have a lot more to do with how the Earth warms and how that influences circulations. But as you start going on thousands of years, you begin thinking about how the great ice sheets will change, how sea level will evolve. And then as you go into the, you know, tens of millions of years, you're beginning to think about how continents will shift and oceans will open and things like that. So you go from the, you know, changes in ocean circulation on the timescale of hundreds of years, the warming from CO2 to more slow and ponderous things like succession in the biosphere. So, you know, forests going away or growing up, permafrost removing, ice sheets retreating. And then on yet longer timescales, there's a bit of a gap there, but then on yet longer timescales, how the shape of the Earth actually changes as the continents slowly move around. And
it's interesting the way you describe it. I was reminded, I'm very interested in the history of science and philosophy and the way that that we thought about things in different periods of history. And a few hundred years ago, when we started finding bones of dinosaurs in the ground, initially there were three possible theories. One was that these forms were created by some sort of force of nature, and they were animals that weren't quite finished yet. They weren't done. The second was that these were remains of animals and plants that haven't been discovered yet, that they're walking around in some remote part of the world, and we haven't run across them yet. And the third, the most daring, was that these were actually the remains of creatures, animals and plants that had once lived but were extinct now, which would suggest that the Earth is much older than we believed before that. It's interesting that we had to change the way that we think about things, because we had no initiative to think about the possibility that there is some form of evolution, or that there's some possibility of finding bones of animals that no longer are with us and that are extremely old. And it definitely enormously lengthened the amount of time that we understood the Earth to be old, which was at the time a completely, you'd have to open a new door of understanding to even comprehend that. And it took ages before we could do that. It's very difficult to think of that now. What are the inhibitions that are preventing us now from understanding something that will become very clear in the future, whether it's near or far? If you were to take a bird's eye view of discovery of the Earth and of Earth systems, obviously we know exponentially more as we go about, as we have more tools. But at the same time, I think we understand that we know very little, and there's so much more to explore. Is this something that scientists think about? I know they focus on different things, but in particular have to look at quite a long bit of history to sort of see the changes and see what we thought might be the future 50, 100, 200 years ago, to look at the question now.
It's always hard to say what other people think.
Let's go with you.
You know, one thing I'm struck by more and more is how hard a new thought is to come by. You hear that when you're young, but I think as time goes by, you appreciate more and more how original thoughts are so rare. And if you've had one, then you can be pretty happy. But most of the time we mimic and repeat thoughts and ideas that we've heard before, sort of variations thereof, and interpolate among them. But a real original thought is hard to come by. And that's one aspect. And the other is how much we rely on stimuli. And that's what's beautiful about, you know, natural science, is that nature is a source of stimuli, which kind of can push you to have new thoughts. I don't know where that comes in art and music, or other creative activities, this external stimulus that doesn't fit into your picture and makes you try to eventually, after you've tried 100 times, to fit it in the conceptualization you already have, leads you to think of a different conceptualization that's new and original. Yeah, so I see that in science, the way that creative process works. And science is like art and music and other creative activities. I just am less clear where their stimuli comes from. Maybe it's not so different. Maybe it comes from the world. Yeah, so you wonder, from a bird's eye view, what are the thoughts that we're missing? Because obviously we are. And how that will change the way we perceive what we're looking at today. And I think about the only thing you can do is realize that the way we look at the world is very much constrained by the history of previous thought. Yeah, and I guess you just have to be a bit humble there and realize that things could look a lot differently.
Do you think it would be easier back when it was impossible to communicate across large lands and different discoveries and explorations were brought up in different areas? I was just reading about Darwin wanting to publish his work, but he was very cautious about publishing it because he saw how criticized others were when they had some sort of theory that didn't match up with the church or with general society. And then he received a paper from someone, another scientist in Australia, which was very close to what he wanted to publish about the theory of evolution. So he immediately published because he understood that there were others. and it was very popular. I think he sold every single copy that he printed, the first copy that he printed.
He writes so beautifully, though. That's also the thing. I mean, that's an interesting one, because he allowed his ideas to develop over time and mature and ripen. And he was a beautiful writer. And so, you know, when it came out so beautifully. That's hardly ever the case. You know, things come out in a more tortured form because, you know, the scientist has the idea and she doesn't really quite know how to put it together, or he. And then the idea kind of comes out, but doesn't really say what the scientist had in mind. So the scientist might have been thinking about it, right? But this ability to communicate it is yet another step. And that often, at least in my experience, requires iteration and practice. And so with Darwin, it kind of, a new idea came out in a fairly polished way because of that process. But that was sort of special, I think.
Do you think it might become easier for scientists that might not want to express their work in a scientific paper? It might become more interesting and, let's say, widespread or easier for scientists when they can use more visual, like not necessarily virtual reality or mixed reality, even just videos and visualizations. Obviously, this is becoming more and more accepted. I think it used to just be, if you just have a video of something, then it's not expert enough. But maybe with more access to being able to watch videos and being able to share through that, would that be another medium where scientists could express the findings that they have rather than just a paper?
Yeah, but I think you see it more and more. So there's different groups like this podcast, right, where you talk about scientific topics and people communicate their ideas at a different level or a different format. I work with a group called latestthinking.org, and they do a really nice job of a format where sort of a 5-minute discussion of a paper result, and the guy who leads it, Payam Sobhani, he's really good at extracting the information from the presenter and formatting things in a way that, in a concise way, helps the listener understand, or the viewer. And they make really good use of graphics. You know, a good cartoonist can explain all sorts of things. And so those were examples. And then, of course, you know, we have virtualization and video, and I think this is also a great way to make things feel real and communicate using all of the senses that someone has. Maybe we don't use smell too much in the communication of science, but who knows, that might be coming.
Maybe that's coming.
but okay. You had this question back when we were going with Darwin. you know, this way of exchanging, because does all of this exchange help people communicate ideas more effectively or not? Or does it help us develop ideas more quickly? And the answer is, I don't know. I can see the way in which you're thinking about that. If science is driven by stimuli and having much more stimuli, you can see ideas maybe develop much more quickly and rapidly. But the other danger is that we're all kind of trapped by the prevailing wisdom, and that can reinforce itself a little bit more easily when we're all interacting, because what we tend to do when we interact is we norm each other, and having someone be able to think on their own outside of being corrected too often by conventional wisdom also has some benefits. So this, you know, being, you kind of notice individually in your own creative process how you can kind of smack away at a problem, your head just kind of goes in circles, and only when you put it aside are you struck by something that makes you think about it in a different way.
I was looking at the Max Planck Institute website, and I like this quote, but you'll have to tell me a little bit more what it means. Insight must precede application. Max Planck said that.
It goes a little bit back to what we were talking about earlier, in the sense that how do you have an original thought? And often if you're just thinking about the application, it traps you in your thinking and confines and narrows it. And so the real breakthroughs kind of stand to the side. You know, the real, you know, when I want to solve the computer program, I just hack and hack, and I normally do the same things and I don't get it. And then when I kind of step aside, I'm like, I can think out of it a bit fresh and original, and I come at a new approach. And often the real breakthroughs come in unexpected ways. You know, they don't come from where you're looking. You know, they often come from stumbling on something where you weren't looking. And so the idea there is that if we really want to expand the frontiers of knowledge, we should pursue knowledge, not pursue application of the knowledge, because knowledge has value in and of itself. Sometimes it's hard to figure out how we might use that. And there's a lot of, let's say, heat generated in producing that, people kind of zeroing in on trivial things. You know, in German, we have this expression, Fachidiot, you know, someone who's just so deep in their subject, they don't know anything about the world and they can't hardly tie their shoes. But sometimes when you let peculiar people drill in that way, they come up with insights which are completely new and original. And so science should be driven by the attempt to gain insight. And then we can figure out how we can use that. And you can go through discovery after discovery after discovery. Sometimes the utility often followed the discovery. It wasn't that, you know, people came up with this discovery and in order to solve a particular problem, they kind of stumbled on something and they realized, this would be good for this, 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 and this. And so it's a little bit this issue of how do we change the emphasis. So when the knowledge is there, of course, we should have legions of people trying to figure out how we can use this knowledge to our benefit. But we shouldn't forget the knowledge creation step. And that's a bit the Max Planck ethos, is that we, you know, in the basic research ethos, is that we should encourage knowledge production in ways that are decoupled from its application, because history has shown that that's useful.
And so much of knowledge is often useful even after 100 years, or it becomes useful after 100 years, but without the preceding research that maybe wasn't as applicable before, you wouldn't get to it afterwards.
Yeah. Like, where would Darwin be? You know, what did he, if he was sort of trying to provide useful research at that time?
Yeah.
what would that have? He wouldn't have got to where he was, right? I mean, so if you go back and look at many discoveries, it of course, it doesn't mean that that's all that we should do. But I think we sometimes confuse what maybe most of the people should do in our normative views of the world with what all of the people should do. And some degree of specialization in society seems useful. So if we have, you know, how much of society's resources can be dedicated to just letting weird people think about the things that they want to think about because it's proven to be useful. You know, so we can allocate a certain amount of GDP for that, you know, 1% of GDP or something. And then we maybe need 10% of GDP to figure out how these weird ideas are useful. But you can go further, you know, communication. I often have this with science communication, that scientists have to be better communicators. And once in a while, you find a few who are good communicators, who like to communicate. That's fine. But should they all be good communicators? Or maybe we could have something called a journalist, or, you know, somebody who has podcasts, who likes to work at that interface and extract knowledge from weird people who don't know really how to speak or tie their shoes, but have something to say. So again, that's specialization. And this goes back to this thing of, you know, how to avoid being overly normative and trying to make everyone kind of approach things in the same way and allow society to be quirky and specialized.
Let's go back to the EVE summit that's gonna be in Berlin at the beginning of July. And you were saying that you've been going around and testing models with simulations. How's that been going?
It's super fun.
Yeah, I imagine.
Yeah, you know, but normally what happens is when we simulate the world in a climate model, you know, we represent the world in terms of quantities which are averaged over large areas. So we kind of say, you know, if we knew the mean air temperature over central Austria, how would this relate to the mean air temperature over northern Germany and things like this? So we just computationally, we can't divide the world into small pieces and look at the interactions between the small pieces. We have to kind of aggregate it into big pieces and look at how the big pieces interact with each other. And so for many of the things that one's interested in as a natural scientist, they kind of get lost in the average. You know, you talk about the average temperature, but actually what's more interesting, or the average wind, but what's more interesting always is the gust, you know, that kind of blows you off your feet, or the really hot day, or the intensity of the rainfall. You know, the rainfall in Japan I was talking about got to about 80 millimeters an hour, so nearly 10 centimeters in 1 hour of rain, you know, falling down. Those are the things that you are fascinated by. And in the models that we've used so far to study climate, they kind of all get lost in the averaging. And it makes it hard to even think physically about them, because we're really talking about the covariances between statistical quantities. So it becomes abstract in a way that is less fun to relate with. And it's not abstract in a way that becomes simpler and elegant. It's just different. And so when we create these new models where we can simulate things on the scale, on more human scales, you know, on scales of, you know, a kilometer, then you begin to see the phenomena that fascinate you in the field, and you see how they play out. And so you can kind of, and you have the whole world in a way there on your desktop, where you can dive in and you find the any given point on Earth, find the most intense rainstorm or the strongest blizzard at any given time, the strongest wind. When does that happen? How does that connect to this part? And so you begin to interact with phenomena rather than look at the covariability among statistics. And it just brings the world to life. And so that's a lot of fun. And EVE is about creating, you know, using the technologies that are now emerging to make that possible for many more people.
What's it like bringing together people from different sectors? So bringing people that focus on climate science, focus just technologically on them, that bring in also the political sector, or I don't know which other sectors might be present, but how does one put that together so that everyone is able to have one conversation?
Yeah, I think AI, that's what it can be good at. So, you know, I was in Japan, like most people who go to Japan. My wife's learning Japanese, but I'm not very good at it. And so I use DeepL, you know, or DeepL, some people call it.
I call it DeepL. Is it DeepL?
I don't know. different people, some call it DeepL, some call it DeepL. So I tend to use that, and it translates things for me. And it allows me to have conversations that I wouldn't be able to have. You know, that's what AI allows you to translate things into, in a language that you can understand. And that's true for Japanese to German or Japanese to English, as it is true for, you know, how to interpret a storm over Africa for a wind engineer versus a tourism official versus the event handler for a football tournament versus, a farmer or someone planning their holidays or something like that. So I think the idea is that AI is sitting, one of the ideas we're developing in EVE is this idea that if we can create climate information, then how to actually use it will be things that AI can help solve. And so we just need to lower the barrier for use and accessibility of the information that we create. And that will enable people to develop tools, translators that allow people to understand that in their own terms. Yeah, so that's one level. You know, that's how I imagine people all interacting. Of course, there's a great fun when you talk to someone from a different field in learning about how they think about things. That's what you get to do, I guess, in the podcast quite a lot, is you just get different people. And it's always nice when somebody says something in a different way or new that you haven't thought of. No matter what field they come from, they bring new insights and ideas about how to think about things. And I find that always enriching. It's like, I didn't think of that. That's cool. And that happens when you bring different people together.
It's become much easier for us to talk about what we do now that AI is so much more known to regular people, both in society and politics, and that this idea is more open. I remember, so what we've done is we've built a digital twin of the globalized world in terms of socioeconomic and geopolitical processes. And we now need to incorporate satellite imagery, but that'll be the next step of evolution in our digital twin. But about 5 years ago, when we were first pitching this to different institutions and like potential collaborants, they were just looking at us like we were crazy. And now it's just normal, like data and AI. It's pretty common to talk about, at least. So it's become much easier to speak between sectors and become more of an interdisciplinary conversation, which is really where the beauty lies for me anyway. And that's kind of what we do on the podcast. We have so many different topics and so many different guests that offer a different point of view on topics such as climate change, as you did. And I think it's really refreshing, and it's good for people to hear multiple views. Your focus is on clouds, which I think is really cool. Obviously, you do a lot of different things, but I was just thinking about it today. I was talking to a colleague and I was dreaming about a world where I would just be focused on one thing rather than 100 different topics and sectors and types of work. What is your favorite thing about clouds?
This ambiguity between being and not being, I think I like about clouds, because cloud is the word we give to something that isn't. Right. It's on one hand, a cloud is an object. If you ask someone to draw a cloud, most kids would draw a cloud. But if you ask, where a cloud starts and where a cloud ends, only on a rare day in a sky where they fit the diagram in our head. But even when you think then of the kind of colloquial use of cloud to refer to things that are distributed and dispersed, so a cloud is a turbulent dispersion of hydrometeors, drops of water. And each little drop might be 10 microns, 15 microns in diameter. And you might have 100 of those in a cubic centimeter. And they're fairly far apart from each other. So how far apart do two drops have to be, I like to ask, before you have two clouds instead of one cloud? What I like about clouds is this ambiguity between, thinking of them as sort of objects or entities that you can almost touch, and the fact that when you zoom in onto them, they become fleeting and go away, and trying to figure out how an object like that influences life on the planet. Yeah, I find that fun. There's a maybe it's the poetry in it, but I like
the poetry, and it's kind of like a metaphor for if you personified knowledge itself, you think you know what you're talking about, and then if you zoom in on it, it just becomes kind of obscure. Because it can turn into so many different things.
It's frustrating, isn't it?
It's frustrating and beautiful. I love that we don't know things and there's still so much to discover. When people start talking about religion, I was like, why do we need religion? There's so much that is unknown and beautiful that we might slowly comprehend, but there'll be so much more. Knowledge will always be endless.
But religion, I think, is also like science. People need to make sense of themselves. We all need a story to tell.
But you can find that in, if you discover something really interesting about plankton or about some animal or about some form of weather pattern. And if you, I guess you need some imagination to look at it as a metaphor, but I feel like you gain more understanding from looking at nature itself rather than.
Maybe, but I think a lot of people, it's always dangerous because I'm not religious, so I don't want to speak for other people, but I could do it on a very practical level. Like if we go back to politics or if we go to directing a lab of scientists, stories are the way we, you know, stories are kind of in vogue. We tell lots of stories about stories these days, but stories are the way, they're the things people tell each other to give cohesion, social cohesion, you know, and that social cohesion could be in the workplace, could be in the society, it could be for a political movement, but we use stories to connect to each other and we fit in each other's stories. So in a lab, the story might be, you know, what is it that we're doing that other people aren't doing? And I noticed too, when you lead organizations and you're, and you don't have a story about what that organization is trying to do, it just makes leadership much harder because then you have to manage tasks. And when there's a story there, people will self-regulate their tasks much better because they, if they can understand how their tasks relates to the story, and if the story is correct, it allows them to manage their affairs much more autonomously. So a story is sort of like a structure which we use to organize ourselves as beings, as social beings. Yeah, and sometimes I think religion is just, you know, serves that purpose.
Last question, what music are you listening to right now?
Yeah, not enough. I tend to listen to old songs that I've always listened to.
Any particular period of time?
Yeah, I'm caught up in the sort of music of the mid 60s to early 70s. You know, I kind of like that. Although, you know, the other day I was sitting somewhere and it's again, I guess early 70s, but it was nice listening to Bob Marley again. So that was
Oh, I can't listen to him anymore. I think I overdid Bob Marley when I was 15.
Yeah, no, I hadn't heard him for a long time. And then I was, I'm like, this is great.
Okay. So early 70s, what's that? Maybe Zombies or Yes. Are they still 60s?
Yeah, not so rocky, more, a little more folky.
Okay.
But I'm a big Bob Dylan fan, but.
I have a Bob Dylan book, and my favorite part about it, it was like reading, it's by him, it's his diaries or whatever it's called. Immediately, it's like he's just walking through the streets and describing the world as it is. And you're thinking, yeah. after 50 pages, you have to remind yourself that this is Bob Dylan. And you do because he meets very famous people, but right. He's just a guy in the streets, which I love.
I like the fact that, you know, the way I saw him in concert not that long ago. I mean, he's getting on, he's above 80 now or something like that. But, you know, and he's one of the most touring people. But at some point, I had this feeling that he just decided in his life he's a musician. And what he does is he makes music. And it's not a job. It's kind of who he is and what he does. And I really like that attitude that this is what I do. And then I do it.
If you enjoyed this episode, subscribe to our podcast so you don't miss the next one. Our guests are experts on AI, climate, globalization, the economy, and much more. Learn a little and be entertained. If you want insights into challenges and decisions you and your business are facing, Gary Big Data Analytics are of unmatched complexity and accuracy. Whether your questions are on the green energy and digital transition, trade and supply chains, or political and security related, contact us for a consultation and see how you can optimize your decision making, how you can know what you need to know. This has been Last Week on Earth with Gary. Until next time, have a great day.